This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
All right, it's my pleasure to kick off the 2013 fall edition of the Distinguished Speaker Series with Jason Spivak. So Jason is the founder and the CEO of Invoca, which was formerly known as Ring Revenue. So we're sort of unveiling the new name a little early. You guys are getting an insider's peek into that. Prior to forming Ring Revenue, or Invoca, Jason was a director and CFO at CallWave. CallWave was a VoIP service that was very, very successful. Jason led the IPO of that company in 2004, and he was a member of the senior team that accomplished 12 consecutive quarters of revenue growth, profitability, and positive cash flow. They built the company up to over 75,000 paying subscribers in a time in the internet world where that was a huge number of paying subscribers for a service. I was with CallWave for a brief time, worked with Jason for about a year, right around the time of that IPO. Prior to CallWave, Jason was the vice president of technology in the M&A practice at Broadview in their Silicon Valley office. They're an investment banker, where he was the execution lead on more than $1.25 billion worth of successful transactions. So he comes into the entrepreneurial world from the banking background. Prior to that, he also had some product management jobs at Nextel, and he also worked at Netopia, where he helped that company with its IPO in 1996. Jason earned his MBA from Northwestern Kellogg School, and he got his BA from a little-known school that has an awesome beach and a surf break, UC Santa Barbara. So he actually came here and worked in a number of extracurricular activities, which you probably mentioned some of them, and I know he was very, very active in the newspaper. So what I try to do, and I explain this to my 122 class, when I bring speakers in, I have a pretty strict criteria. They've got to have a great story. They've got to be a compelling speaker. They have to have a lot of lessons they can impart upon you. In addition, I really want people that have a balanced view of success, not just people that have made a lot of money. I destroyed a lot of people along the way and left a wake of destruction behind them. They're out there. They're out there. I typically don't. In fact, I never invite those people. I really look for people that are role models for you guys, so that successful people in business, but also successful people in life. And Jason is a great example of that. Jason, despite growing a startup that's growing at an incredible pace, he's already giving back to the community. He lends a helping hand all the time to entrepreneurs that just might have a question. He's mentored a lot of entrepreneurs. He's sponsored hackathons and meetups and various other organizations. He's also very active in the Young Presidents Organization, and he's the chairman of his daughter's elementary school foundation, which, believe it or not, takes up a crap load of time. So he's giving back to the community. He's helping other entrepreneurs. He's running one of the most successful startups here in Santa Barbara. And he also has been very, very successful as a family man. He met his beautiful wife here at UCSB. They're still together. They have wonderful children. He's a devoted father and a devoted husband. And that's the kind of person I think all of you guys can be. You can be successful in business, and you can also be successful in your personal life. Let's welcome Jason to our class.
Thank you, John. Is this on? We good? So welcome, everyone. I appreciate taking the time today. I know there's a football game on that I'd like to be watching as well. Rams are up 3-0, but a lot of game left. So quick show of hands. Any Niner fans in the room?
Let's go.
Okay, I'm going to talk to this group right here. So, John, I appreciate the introduction. You make it sound all nice and polished and put together. And part of what I wanted to spend the time with you guys on today was helping you understand how you can go, if you want to, from sitting here as a student to being able to deliver a path of success for yourself, for your family, create a lot of opportunity for folks around you. There is not a magic formula that, at least there's not one that I know of that I can share today. All I can do is share the experiences that I've had. And if you'd told me 25 years ago when I was sitting in this room taking exams that I'd be up here having the chance to speak to you guys today, I would have asked you what you were smoking. Actually, I would have known what you were smoking. So I'm happy just to share some of the experience I've had. I'd like for it to be as interactive as possible. But we can save some time at the end for questions. I know we kicked off a little bit late here. If you have questions, things that relate to you, things that are interesting to you, please just raise your hand as we're going. I'm happy to address them as we can, and we'll also save some time at the end as well. So I know what you guys are thinking coming into this. That's not what we're going to do today. This is what we're going to do today. So fasten your seatbelts. What I'd like to do is just briefly sort of establish my credibility here today, and then impress you with this awesome company that John talked a little bit about. John's actually on our board of directors and is one of our lead investors in the company. So in addition to being incredibly smart, he has lots of good reasons to talk it up. So thank you. And then spend a little bit of time just talking through kind of how I got here from sort of bumbling my way through UCSB and a rather auspicious start over in Santa Rosa dorm hall to being here, having experiences that are hopefully worth sharing with you folks today. Spend a little bit of time talking through how you guys can get to where you want to go, and then save some time for questions. So quick show of hands before we dive in. Seniors? Okay, like real seniors, like going to graduate this year, not like first-year seniors? Okay. All right, so here's my background. John talked a little bit about it. UCSB undergrad, graduated here in 1990. I won't ask for a show of hands as to how many of you were alive in 1990. I'm going to guess it's less than half the room. You, I got. Thank you. I was standing outside here looking at Phelps Hall, and when I was in school here, there was something called the microcomputer lab on the ground floor of Phelps Hall. That was where you went to go use a computer, because believe it or not, there was one person on my dorm hall in 1986 that had a computer. It was a Mac 512, and it had a screen this big on a big blocky box, and it's because his mom worked at Apple. And so we all used to sign in to use his computer, whether he wanted us in his dorm room or not. Anybody know what this is? Anybody know what it holds? How much? 1.44 megabytes. You got issued this as a freshman here in 1986. You wrote your name on it, and you carried it around for 4 years. And it stored all the documents you ever needed for 4+ years of college here. Seriously, the irony is that that disk could not hold that image of the disk today. So we all had these in our backpacks with our names on them and our perm numbers, which I still remember. And that was all you needed for all your computing for 4 years of school. So graduated UCSB in 90, joined an exciting company up in the Bay Area that was, they had this crazy vision that people were going to have mobile telephones. And I wasn't sure I bought into the concept, but it was an exciting company. I got talked into it by a friend. I had the chance to work with Nextel Communications. We took that company public in 92. I say we, I was pretty junior there, but I had the random lucky bounce of my cube was literally right outside the president's office, even though I was just a pricing analyst at the company. So I got a lot of great exposure there. From there, following that IPO, we had I joined a company called Netopia. At the time, it was Farallon Computing. And we did remote access, remote control, something that software, something that John knows a lot about from the old, the pre-go-to-my-PC days. We took that company public in 1996. I went back to school, got my MBA at Northwestern. From there, moved into mergers and acquisitions, technology investment banking at pretty much the ideal time from 98 to 2000. Some of you were alive by then. It was this big thing called the internet bubble. And so we did a tremendous volume of high-value transactions over those few years, incredible education. From there, moved to Santa Barbara. I joined a company that was about a year old at the time called CallWave. It was struggling to figure out what it was going to be, but there was a great team there and a great market opportunity. We grew that, as John said, to pretty significant financial success and took that company public in 2004. I co-founded a venture fund here in town, and also we started Ring Revenue in 2007. So looks good. We're going to come back and sort of dissect this in a few minutes. So all was good, right? I had, you know, hot wife, a cool ride, some money for candy. Right? It's all good. But how did we get here? So let me take a moment to tell you about our company. And yes, this is going to tie into your future by the end of this. So pay attention here. So welcome to Invoca. Many of you may have heard of the company as Ring Revenue. We do a lot of recruiting here in town, a lot of engineering recruiting here at UCSB. We are in the process of rebranding the company as Invoca. And this is actually the first official letting out of it. We have a big launch scheduled in about 2 weeks. So before I dive into what we do, let me ask you, what drove the growth of the internet? What made the internet such a sustaining and significant business evolution for us? Was it all the cute baby pictures? Or the endearing photos of people with their loving pets? No, it was measurability. It was attribution, right? The internet evolved, came into being, and the ability to track someone's process, to track a click or an action from viewing one thing to taking an action with another over here. Searching on something, viewing a web page or a banner ad, clicking through it, landing on a business web page where they sell a product or service, and taking an action or making a purchase there. The fact that we are able to track that purchase, that revenue for the business, all the way back to the lead source and see all the activity of the consumer across that process, the funnel that brought them to a transaction, so to speak, that's what drove the growth of the internet. There's an old saying that you guys may have heard, that I know half my advertising dollars are wasted, I just don't know which half, right? The internet made it possible to know which of your media spend, your advertising spend, was working to bring you customers and which wasn't. So over time, that drove the growth of some pretty significant companies that you guys are probably familiar with, right? Facebook, Twitter, LinkedIn, Google, Yahoo, right? $50 billion in combined revenue for these companies last year. More than half of that was Google, by the way. Incredible company, incredible business model. It's going to be around long after all of us. So big market opportunity, $50 billion a year of advertiser spend. Invoca is targeting a much, much larger market. There's over $300 billion spent by advertisers in the U.S. every year. Only about $50 billion of that is online, that whole world of Google and Facebook and Yahoo that we all know. The other $250 trillion is being spent every year not to drive a click, but to drive a different kind of customer engagement, a phone call. Tens of billions of phone calls from U.S. consumers to U.S. businesses every year. We're all carrying phones around in our pockets. That wasn't happening 15 years ago. And there's no internet-like tracking or attribution of those sales that occur in the call center when you call in to purchase a plane ticket or a laptop or auto insurance or a cruise, whatever it is. There's no effective tracking for that advertiser to know which of their marketing spend out here, their ad dollars, drove you to become a customer in their call center. So that's exactly what we do. We're bringing internet-like tracking to that other $250 trillion of spend every year. It's a pretty exciting opportunity. So why is so much money spent to get you to call into businesses? It's because those phone calls convert into customers at a much, much higher rate than clicks do. Think about it. If you're visiting a website and you are searching for a plane ticket, right, and you are in the process of configuring that search and you go to check the Niners score and dancing hamsters, right, you're off over here somewhere and you're never coming back. So conversion rates of 1% to 2% on websites typically, and it's a pretty broad range. Phone calls, when you call in and you have that agent on the line, and that trained agent is taking you through the purchase process, as well as all the cross-sells, the upsells, the trip cancellation insurance, the extended warranties, etc., the conversion rate goes way up because, frankly, you're a lot more committed to that purchase process by the time you've pulled out your phone. And also, you just don't drift away from a phone conversation the way that you would from a website, right? You're not going to be on the phone with somebody and go check the sports scores and just go drifting off. So the conversion rates are much higher, the average order values are higher, so those advertisers really want those calls. As a result, they're willing to pay their media partners, their advertising, a heck of a lot more for a phone call than they would for a web click from that same person. And what's amazing is, and I think we can all relate to this, we're searching on our phones more and more than on our laptops. And mobile search is driving billions more phone calls every year. Because once you've found what you're looking for, do you want to thumb in your 16-digit credit card number and your billing address and all that stuff? You're going to find what you're looking for, and you're going to tap the button, and you're going to put it to your head. So it's driving billions more phone calls a year. Our market is huge and exploding on an annual basis. So what we are is we are marketing automation for inbound calls. And that marketing automation is kind of a $5 word if you guys aren't out in the workplace yet. But basically, it takes a lot of the complicated functions that marketing people do within big businesses like Apple or United Airlines or Liberty Mutual Insurance or Home Depot, for example, and automates a lot of those repetitive functions in software, where the marketing manager doesn't have to go get a lot of help from the IT department to go set up phone call prompts and things like that. So we automate that entire process. We're the first mover in a huge market. It's cloud-based SaaS or software as a service model, highly recurring, highly visible revenue stream. We're targeting Fortune 5,000 companies as our customers, sort of a who's who list. And we've had very significant growth over the last few years. These are the numbers that really matter to me, looking at the last 10 quarters of revenue growth here. So keep this in mind. We're gonna come back to how this relates to you in a few minutes here. So that was my chance to plug Invoca and keep practicing saying the name, which I'm starting to fall in love with. So how did I get here? Let's go back and take a look at that bio, right? Looks like there's a nice, consistent flow, maybe even a plan behind it. I can guarantee you that there wasn't. Let me take you through the things that don't show up on people's resumes, because while many of you are going to have this kind of success, you're going to work with great teams and great companies, you're going to start great companies, you're also going to have a great share of failure and hesitation and uncertainty and random bounces, some of which send you in the right direction and some of which won't. So to start with, what doesn't show up on a resume? Well, I made the very fortunate mistake of moving on to DP my sophomore year and Oceanside. So it added one more year to my college education, all things considered. But it was an amazing opportunity. And frankly, how in the hell are you supposed to get anything done when this is the view from your deck? So lived on DP, five-year plan, came out of here with a pretty dismal GPA, frankly. I got an amazing education. I was the managing editor of the Nexus, which, with all due respect to the current Next sites, I know it's probably not a primary source of information for you guys today. You're all carrying the internet around in your pockets now. Back then in the 80s, it was the only source of information for people. We dominated the collective student agenda with what we put on the front page. There was no internet, there was no Wikipedia, there were not even cell phones. I know this was only 25 years ago. But what we put in the newspaper was what everybody talked about. So it was an amazing time to be running that newspaper. We had a blast. That really was my education. I really didn't give a darn about my grades. I hope my kids don't watch this. But the Nexus was where I learned everything that, and of course, in our apartment on DP where we had to cram a rotating group of eight guys and girls in there just to be able to pay the rent. So there's a lot that doesn't show up on the resume, right? I'm approaching graduation here. I don't know what I'm going to do next. I was in my second senior year, and I had not picked my major yet. So I read the other day that the average incoming GPA at UCSB is like a 4.1 now, incoming from high school. That's insane. I would never have gotten in here, ever. Mine was even worse coming out, frankly. So I didn't know what I wanted to do, and I looked at where I had the most units, and it was in poli-sci, and I could graduate the fastest by cramming 20 units of poli-sci for 3 quarters. So that's what I did. Ask me about Marxism, really. It has helped me out tremendously. So I didn't know what I was going to do, and I decided that I would go straight to graduate school and go get a PhD in political science, which was my newfound love. And so I took the GRE, did well on that exam, applied to schools, got into the PhD program at University of Colorado at Boulder. I thought, hey, 4 or 5 years on the beach, 4 or 5 years in the mountains, not a bad deal. Registered, enrolled, ready to go. And I was actually going to open a Freebirds in Boulder because Freebirds had just opened my sophomore year. I know, it gets weirder. So, and my friend Mark owned Freebirds, which, by the way, at the time wasn't burritos or quesadillas or anything. It was whole chickens delivered to your apartment. And when you ordered 8 of them, you got a free bird the 9th time. You got a whole chicken cut up into 8 pieces. Yes, I'm serious. I'm serious. So So I was going to open the Freebirds in Boulder, and that was the big plan. The mark was crushed when we didn't move, but literally last minute, my wife, my girlfriend at the time, says, I don't think I want to move to Colorado. So I said, it would have been good to know sooner. You've got your stuff all worked out, right? You're staying for your teaching credential. You got another year at Santa Barbara. What am I going to do? So I canceled that, and I went up to San Francisco I was graduating winter quarter because my schedule was a little screwy. And I went up to San Francisco for a New Year's Eve party with some friends of mine that had graduated on time and already gone and gotten jobs and had an apartment. And I had such a good time in the city that I moved onto their couch, and I never came back. So I'm sure I skipped some important things here. No, there I am. So I didn't have a job. I had no clue, frankly, and jobs were pretty hard to get. We were deep in the middle of the first Bush recession at that time, and there were no jobs. And so I got a job selling umbrellas to tourists in Union Square. I did meet Joe Montana on that job. $6 an hour plus a dollar per umbrella. So I would get up in the morning and literally hope that it was going to rain that day. Here's my assistant drumming up a little bit of business. So sold umbrellas, eventually found through a family member a really great job working nights, inputting attorneys' timesheets, handwritten timesheets, into this monochrome amber monitor and into their billing software. So did that for a while. That led to meeting some of the attorneys in the firm, which led to being given some research work, which led to doing some regulatory filings, which were fun, for a company called Nextel Communications, actually called Fleet Call at the time. Met the attorneys on that side, became friends with them, interviewed for a job at Nextel and got that. So that's how I ended up there, right? Nothing too exciting about that process other than leveraging relationships. So worked there for a while, decided that I wanted to follow in the footsteps of most of my family members and become an attorney. So I took the LSAT, did well on that, applied to law schools, got in, registered, enrolled at UC Davis for law school, and literally the days before we were going to leave, my wife, still girlfriend at the time, said, I don't think I want to move to Davis. So I'm not kidding. And she'll probably watch this too. So again, I said, would have been good to know sooner. So I canceled that and tried to figure out what I was going to do. And about a year after that, I took the GMAT. So I've now taken nearly every standardized exam that exists. So I decided I was going to go to business school. At the same time, a little bit earlier, I had left Nextel because the headquarters, and Craig McCaw had bought a controlling interest in Nextel and wanted to move the headquarters up to Seattle. So we went up there for our weekend real estate tour to see if we were going to move. It rained like hell. I mean, horizontal rain coming at you for two straight days. And we cut that trip short and said we weren't moving. So I left Nextel. I joined a company called, at the time, Farallon Computing. It was now called Netopia. It's just acquired by Motorola recently. And during that time frame, I decided that I wanted to go to business school. I had a friend who went to the school called Kellogg that I'd never heard of. And he was having a great time. And he was back to wearing shorts and riding his bike. And I thought, I got to get back and do that. So it was the only school I applied to. I got in and registered and enrolled. We had just taken Farallon public at that point in time as well, so I made what I thought was a fortune. It was actually a really small amount of money, but to me at the time, it was game-changing, five figures. So I get into Kellogg, registered, enrolled, and my now wife says, and you guys probably know where this is going, right? I don't think I want to move to Chicago. So as I explained to her, I had taken everything but the MCAT, and if we did not go to business school, I was going to become a doctor, and I did not want to do that. So we shook hands and agreed that we would move right back to our same San Francisco neighborhood 2 years later, no matter where the job offers came from. When I left after the IPO at Farallon, this is 1996, the tech market, Silicon Valley, was red hot. Netscape had just gone public, and it was the first mega deal. And the market was off the hook, and nothing was sustainable. It was crazy. And so people were asking me, why would you want to leave this? This is insane. This is where all the money is going to get made. I didn't really have a good answer, but I called my uncle, who is really the most business-minded person in my family, and I said, Kerry, what do I do? I'm sitting on like $70,000 worth of stock options in this company, but I got into Kellogg, which is the top business school in the world. what should I do? And I can't use the language here that he used because we're being filmed, but he just said, you're a freaking idiot if you don't go. So that was good advice from somebody that I trusted. And so I went ahead and went to business school, came out 2 years later, and the market had gone from red hot to white hot by 1998. I mean, people were getting multiple six-figure job offers without even interviewing for them coming out of that school. It was insane at the time. So I got recruited into Broadview, which is now part of Jefferies. It was one of the leading mergers and acquisitions banks in Silicon Valley at the time. So coming out of Northwestern, I'm saddled with massive student debt. That was the trade-off I made. I traded all these stock options for a bunch of debt. Go figure. And I joined Broadview, which was a great experience. I came in there feeling like I was just a poser, right? I did not have a financial background. I looked at all these other folks who were joining in the same class that I was at Broadview. They all came out of Harvard. They all had finance degrees. They'd all been working in finance roles. I didn't know squat, man. I had sold umbrellas. So it was damn near terrifying in the beginning. But I dove in, and I remember coming home one day, and my wife asked me, how was work today? I said, oh, I got to do this, and I'm working on this deal, and I have to produce this thing, and I don't know how to do that. And then she's like, it's your first day. So I dove in. I learned it. I was very, very fortunate to work with a number of successful bankers who sort of took me under their wing, showed me how to do it, got some amazing transactions done, and 15 years later, they are still some of my very closest friends. In fact, John's partner, Jim Andelman, at Rincon Ventures, also worked at Broadview that same time that I was there. So I've known Jim for 15 plus years now. So took on a lot of debt, went to Broadview, loved it. The challenge with it was I was all of a sudden surrounded by a bunch of millionaire bankers, and they were throwing money like water at these stupid dot-com deals. And to them, it was nothing, right? These guys could chip in 50K, 100K, 200K, and it was nothing. And I recall we sort of junior peons petitioned for our right to sidecar, to co-invest with them in these deals, even though we weren't what was called Reg D accredited investors. They built a vehicle for us that we could invest in, so the short answer is all of us really poor, hardworking junior people there just lost a ton of money. I lost practically everything I had during those 2 years. I'm making a bunch of money, which for me was a lot. I was making, you know, $150,000, $175,000 a year back then, which was a lot. And I was literally dumping it all back into these startups, as were most people who were working there. So there was not a whole lot of genius that was going on at the time. So lost money on those investments, left Broadview when my wife, in early 2000, she was a school teacher at the time, and I brought home a funny story from work, and she sat up in bed and said, that's not funny, that's true, this whole thing's about to crash, how long do we have to stay here? And her rationale was so clear that I gave notice. I had the, oh crap, what have I done with my career moment. And then I gave notice at Broadview, and we sold out of what investments we had, and we spun the globe, and we picked Santa Barbara because we had had the best time of our lives here. And we just had our first kid, and we were looking for where to raise a family. So we moved down here, and a month later, NASDAQ went off a cliff in March, April of 2000. So good timing. One of the top magazines at the time did a big feature story on my wife calling the top of the market. And 6 months later, that magazine, Industry Standard, was gone as well. So so came down to Santa Barbara. I had no job. We attempted to start a company, which did not go well, which I won't go into a lot of details. I did join CallWave, which was exciting for me. I came in initially as a contractor because I was a banker coming to little Santa Barbara. And I met the chairman here, actually, at UCSB. I came here, I had no job, I had no plan. I attended a business plan competition here, which you guys are probably familiar with and many of you have participated in. And at the break, I was talking with this guy that, 45-year-old guy with a cast on his arm, and how'd you break your arm? Skateboarding. And we started to talk, and he was an investor in a company called CallWave that was about a year old and wasn't sure what it was going to do because the bottom was sort of falling out of the internet advertising revenue market, which is what they were based on at the time. He asked me to come in for a 90-day consulting engagement to sell the company to some Silicon Valley company. I said, hey, I'm a banker. I could do that. So 4.5 years later, we took it public. It was a tremendous ride. Worked with some really incredible people, and we were able to grow that company to deliver a revenue chart that looks pretty much like the one I just put up here a few minutes ago. So Left CallWave about a year after the IPO. Co-founded a venture fund, which is actually doing pretty well. I got some news on that today, which is good. Also co-founded another startup, which is based on a technology out of UCSB. So I won't go into a lot of detail about it, other than the fact that it's one of those ones that just kind of moves along for a long time. So it's 5-6 years in and still has all its potential and very little of it realized yet. That's a very common situation for early stage companies. Invested in a few more startups and lost that money as well. And then finally got smart and partnered with some of my former colleagues from CallWave and launched Ring Revenue. And the concept being that advertisers wanted to work with ad networks, which would bring together media partners, right, publishers essentially as they're called, that were willing to take the risk of buying media or placing media or spending their own dollar to drive visitors to your web page. And they would only get paid by you if the visitors they drove bought something, right? They get a share, they get a revenue share. It's performance marketing is what it's called. And the challenge there was that when a media partner, a publisher, would drive traffic tracked by the ad network in the middle to this advertiser's landing page, if there was a phone number on the page and someone called that phone number, remember, they convert at a much higher rate, so the advertiser loves that. But that transaction was no longer being tracked by the ad network, so the media partner over here was not getting paid for it. And we approached the ad networks and said, we can build something to solve that problem for you, which we did. And that was the foundation of Ring Revenue. So it's been a fantastic ride for us. We've had great revenue growth. We have an incredible product. We're very aggressive in pursuing patents. So we have several patents issued around what we do. We just took over a building in downtown Santa Barbara, which we've moved. We've grown in the last 3-4 months from about 30 people to about 65 people. We just took over a great building right in the heart of downtown, and we had the good sense to convert the basement into a full Irish pub. So whoever wants to, I'm sure right now, it's full of people having a beer, playing ping pong, getting some foosball and darts in, listening to music, maybe getting some karaoke on. So we've got a great team. I'd say of the 30 or so people we've hired in the past half a year, average age is probably 25, 26. So there's great opportunity for people who are coming out of school or with just a couple of years experience there. So that's my background. And what I'd love to spend the rest of the time that we have here on is seeing what we can do in these next few minutes to help you guys get a sense of how you can go where you'd like to go. So advice is tricky, so I try and do it by example as opposed to just trying to tell people what to do. My strong suggestion is this is the best time in your life to take chances. I mean, what do you have to lose, right? As you get older, you get encumbered with more and more responsibility. When I was selling umbrellas for $6 an hour in San Francisco, I could pay my $300 rent to stay in my buddy's dining room. I had enough money for beer and pizza and pool every night. My Scirocco didn't need much work. I felt wealthier then than at any time in my life. And I had no overhead. I had no risk at all. That was the time where it didn't matter much if you failed at something because the cost of failure is so low. Your risk profile will never be lower than it is today. There's a gratuitous photo of my son that I get to sneak in here. He was actually just playing water polo in the pool here a little while ago. This was about 10 years ago. We were at a little carnival. He was 3.5 or 4. He climbed to the top of this slide, and he was terrified to go down it. He stood up there for probably 10 minutes. And we're at the bottom going, come on, Ben. Right? He stood up there probably 10 minutes, all the other kids going around him. He finally got up the courage to make the jump. And I happened to get this picture right as he was coming down, and it's the exact moment that the fear turned to joy in his eyes, and he was so happy with the decision that he made to do that. And so this is the point you guys are at. You have nothing to lose at this stage in your lives by taking that jump. If you've got an awesome idea, something you know cannot miss, you got to go for it, right? There's no downside to you guys to taking that risk today, unless you've got some awesome job already lined up or you've got something mapped out. This is the best time in your lives to take risk. And even if the idea is not that awesome, this I would not recommend. But anything above that, that's not risk. Right? This is risk, right? flying a wingsuit at 200 miles an hour through a stone arch. That has consequences. Taking a chance on your idea? Not much, actually. It's fun. So the second thing, and I think this has been sort of the guiding factor in my life so far, is really, I look back and every great opportunity I've had has come from relationships with people. There's no doubt that luck is involved, right? If you ever played fantasy football, you know that the best laid plans all get tossed up in the air, and there's so much left to chance in life. But everything comes from opportunity, from relationships that you make with people. I mean, when I was at Nextel, going back to like 1993, right, I got invited to the holiday party that the senior team was throwing for themselves because I happened to sit next to the president's office, and he knew my name. And so since I overheard all the conversations, at one point he was like, hey, we're having the party at Kevin's house tonight, our VP of marketing. You should come. And so it was in Lafayette in the East Bay, which is where Nextel was headquartered at the time. And so we're there, and these guys are playing pool, and my wife and I, my girlfriend and I, are sort of standing off in the corner. I'm super junior. There's all these big swinging senior executives. And they're playing pool. They were starting up a game of doubles that they were betting $100 on, which was a lot of money to me at the time. And one of them needed a partner, this guy Kevin, it was his house, the VP of marketing. And I'm standing there, he's like, you play pool? I'm like, all right, you're my partner. So we play pool against him and Jim Dixon, the president of the company, and his partner, Wade Veazey, the VP of engineering. And it comes down to me having to make a bank shot all the way across the table to bank the eight ball in. And here's the luck, it goes in, right? Because I made that one meaningless pool shot, all those guys knew my name, even though I was about 12 levels below them in the company. From then on, I was getting high fives in the break room from the president of the company. Go figure. So I wish I was making that up. So focus on the relationships. Focus on the people more than the money or the things at this stage in your career. Those opportunities you get through people, the opportunity to create mentors, people who actually want to take the time to help you along, that's what's going to move you forward. It's not, I mean, think about it, you're going to go get a job out of here and you're going to have a choice between a job making $60,000 over here or a job making $50,000 over here, but you like this team and you like these people and you like this market opportunity, right? $10,000 after tax, $6,000, right? That's $500 a month. That's about $15 a day, right? That's what you want to base your career decisions on? Probably not. Right in the very beginning, you're going to spend every dollar you make anyway. So, seriously.
Oh, no, it's so true.
I mean, it doesn't matter how much you make. You're going to spend it all at this stage. So focus on those opportunities where you can work with great people and learn from them and figure out at this very early stage of your careers, at the very beginning, find those things that you want to put in your toolbox. And also learn those lessons of things that you don't want in your toolbox from observing other people. But the relationships, the mentoring is the most valuable contribution to your career that I think you can make today. Use the tools that are available to you guys. Again, most of you are seniors looking toward graduation 6-8 months down the road. So I won't embarrass by calling out and saying, hey, who's got a job lined up? But I'm guessing that most of you are still trying to figure out what you want to do when you get out of school. So there are some invaluable tools that you can use to get ahead, both in your job search and your career. Show of hands, how many people here have a LinkedIn account? More than half. That's great. LinkedIn is like the professional Facebook, right? So it's not where you put the keg stands, and it's not where you put the beach photos. It is essentially your resume online. We interview a ton of people. I'm on LinkedIn every single day, every day. I've got probably 5 LinkedIn tabs open right now. I don't get on a phone call with a customer, a prospect, an interview candidate, anything, without going on LinkedIn, looking at their background, seeing who we know in common. I will even, if I'm on the phone trying to get a business deal done, I will look at where that person went to school. I will go look up football scores, and I will ask him if he's watched the game that Saturday. And I'm ready to talk about it if he did. So LinkedIn is an incredibly powerful tool. And for those of you that are not using it, that you're not on it, get on it. For those of you that are on it but not actively using it, start using it. The more people that you connect to on LinkedIn, the more access you have to jobs and opportunities. Like, I've got a couple thousand connections on LinkedIn. So if you were to connect to me, all of a sudden you're connected to a couple thousand people at interesting technology companies here, Bay Area, LA, everywhere, and you want to go apply for a job at Google, you check LinkedIn and you see I'm connected to 32 people at Google, you're now going to email me and say, hey, can you introduce me to so-and-so? And if we got a working relationship, I probably will. So connect to John. You can connect to me. I'll put my email address up here later. Use it actively. It's the best professional networking tool that exists today. The next is Quora. How many people are familiar with Quora? Okay, so fewer. I mean, probably not more than a quarter of the room. Quora is the best place to go find answers. It's like Yahoo Answers, but populated by smart professionals. It's also a little bit of an addiction for Silicon Valley venture capitalists. When they curl up with their laptop at night, it's to browse questions that they can answer on Quora, and then people vote up answers. So if you're not familiar with Quora, go to it, type in any kind of, I mean, they don't have to be professional questions. I mean, literally, if you want to find out what the average person, what the tooth fairy gives the average kid, you'll find that on Quora too. So go check it out if you haven't already. You can find the answers to what you're looking for. If you want to know why one company succeeded and another one failed, even though they seem similar, someone has posted that question, you will see the CEOs of those two companies logging in with their answers. So it's pretty cool. Also, there are a lot of blogs out there that you guys should start to pay attention to. I'm kind of myopically focused on, bless you, on tech. So a lot of what I follow and read about is technology, emerging technology. For those of you that are interested in entrepreneurship, starting your own businesses, and technology, there are a handful of blogs that I would highly recommend. John's, not just because he's in the room, but because it's very well written. And John is actually, I'll embarrass you for the heck of it, my first friend to have the official Wall Street Journal dot matrix profile picture done. So for those of you that read the Wall Street Journal. So there are a few blogs I would pay attention to here. InfoChotchke, Both Sides of the Table, is an amazing read by a venture capitalist down in Southern California who has been a successful entrepreneur, having built and sold companies, and is now a successful venture capitalist. Very balanced and insightful, pulls no punches view there. And then for those of you who are looking at topics relating to early stage company development, startups essentially, the OpenView blog is very actionable, very practical nuts and bolts for folks who are actually starting companies and managing early stage companies. That's a fantastic read. There are others as well. These are a few that I hit on a regular basis. But there's so much information out there to help you guys make good choices and learn from other people's mistakes instead of making them all yourself. So this one will now go against all the professional stuff I just said a moment ago. But see as much of the world as you can. It does not take a big budget to travel. My wife and I have a goal of going to every country in the world. And it's ambitious. I think I'm going to die trying, would be my guess. My grandparents had the same goal, and they got to 200 plus before they slowed down. And I think there were only about 250 back then. So get out and travel as much as you can. It does not take a lot of money, right? You need to get there, but you can live cheap. I mean, how many people have backpacked through Europe or South America or Asia, right? For the other half that haven't, your life will be a much, much richer experience if you're able to travel and experience other cultures. So, yes, I can throw some gratuitous travel photos that I've taken over the years up there. There has been nothing more rewarding for me, especially now that we have a family and we drag our kids all around. It's a little bit tougher with a startup. I can't get away for a six-week trip or an eight-week trip anymore. But it's been so much more rewarding for us to be able to expose ourselves and our kids to other cultures and understanding how the rest of the world lives. The U.S. is a bubble. It's a big bubble, but it's a bubble. And so it's great to have that exposure. I can't recommend this strongly enough. I preach this at our company as well, encouraging our team to travel. And unfortunately, one of our best marketing managers took me up on it, and she moved to Germany a few months ago. But we love her, and we respect that, and I would encourage you guys all to do the same. So, and then lastly, keep higher education in mind. You guys are going to go through a stretch of a few years here when you come out of school. You're going to be working your way up the ladder, starting your own companies, working for other people's companies. That siren call for continued education may start ringing for you guys at some point in the future. speaking only from my own experience, when I was pretty adrift by the time I'd made the decision to go to business school, it was a turning point for me. It was a tremendously positive experience, not just professionally, but some of my best friends came from that experience. So I would encourage that. And lastly, how can you get where you want? Come work at Invoca. Come check out our jobs page. We're hiring. So with that, I want to be mindful of time here. I'm not sure what time we wrap here. It's about 20 till. But hopefully we've got a couple of minutes for questions here. Yeah. Yes?
I'm kind of curious on when you came in as the vice president of, I forget the company's name, and you were saying that you didn't have the knowledge base that everyone else did, and I'm kind of curious how you developed yourself to be a more substantial, you know, contributor in that kind of company.
It's a shame this is being filmed, but so I went and interviewed, and when I was asked if I knew how to use Excel, I lied and said yes. And so they said, that's great. When you come back on Monday for interviews, they'll probably just have you run a couple of examples. I'm like, yeah, no problem. So I bolt out of that interview, and I call my one friend who had a laptop, and I said, dude, I got to borrow your computer for the weekend. And I went to the bookstore, and I bought a tutorial. He had a Mac. It was a MacBook laptop, which I wasn't using Mac at the time, and I wasn't that familiar with it. And I bought a tutorial with a diskette, and I spent the weekend going through all 32 chapters of that Excel tutorial so that on Monday I was ready to demonstrate that I knew what a formula wizard was and other very, very, very basic stuff. So,
that's great.
And then when I got the job and they asked, what kind of computer do you want? I only knew Excel on a Mac. So I'm like, I need a Mac. So, I wish there was a more glamorous answer to it, but
I wanted to get your opinion. I'm going to be graduating this quarter with a master's in engineering, and I have an idea for opening a business that has absolutely nothing to do with engineering. So would you suggest trying to pursue that first or going out and getting an engineering job first just so I have something to fall back on and have that experience to kind of build a reputation?
That's a great question. I think that there are a couple of disciplines. One is engineering, another is law, which hopefully none of you guys are currently doing. That are sort of like just knowing another language, right? You have an engineering education. You understand how things work, whether it's structural, mechanical, civil, or software engineering, computer engineering. You never lose that as long as you have the passion to stay current with the evolution in the industry. My advice, to the point there isn't any, is go do what fires you up the most. If you like it, you're a lot more likely to be successful simply driven by your passion and your desire to learn about it and succeed than you would be going to take a job as a programmer or a coder at another company. And frankly, you're coming at what kind of engineering?
Mechanical.
Okay. So I know this sounds crazy to say. You're not going to have a lot of trouble finding a job. So mechanical engineers are in demand. Computer science majors are in demand. We're going to put a timestamp on this video by me saying this, but we hire computer science undergrads straight out of UCSB. We actually have an internship program. We convert about half of those to full-time engineers once they graduate. We and other companies here in town, starting salary for brand new undergrads, $75,000 to start. So, and we can't find enough of them. So engineering is, from a financial standpoint, it's a very safe career path, it's a very safe degree path. And if you went out and tried your hand at what you wanted to do, and for some reason it did not work out the way you wanted to, honestly, again, your risk profile is pretty close to zero. You probably got some student loan payments you got to make.
Yeah.
But I would encourage you to go pursue your passion, and I don't think you'll have a great deal of difficulty finding a role with a master's in mechanical engineering. So, sir?
How did you explain your low GPA to employers in the beginning? And not that I have a low GPA. Not that I have a low GPA.
Why do you ask? my roommate, the one guy who had the computer, by the way, his grades were so bad that on his resume, he put his relevant GPA, was what he had on there. And relevant was whatever class you got an A in. So how did I explain my low GPA? So I graduated with a 3.1 from UCSB. Thank you. It took me 5 years to earn that. I spoke to employers. First of all, I went immediately down a career path that didn't care much about your GPA. Now, many of the big ones do, right? You're going to work for a consulting firm, an investment bank. Larger companies really care about your GPA. The path I took, selling umbrellas and then kind of backdooring into a little paralegal work and then using relationships to kind of move into a role at Nextel, really at no point in time was my GPA significantly questioned. But when I did, for example, have to write essays for graduate school three times, I spoke about the real-world education I had from running the Nexus. I mean, I was 20 years old. I was running a staff of 100 people here. I had a budget of over $1 million to manage, and I had a red pen in one hand and a beer in the other the whole time, and that was actually my education. So it was a little bit different because the newspaper wasn't even digitized back then. We would do it actually on these big boards back in production at the Nexus. Anybody here work at the Nexus while you were here? One, two. Come on, you guys can admit it. So the whole back area production used to be all these big flats where we would print out sheets of articles and we would roll them with wax, sticky wax, onto these things and straighten them out. We'd use blue pens to mark where changes needed to be made. And a big box of these flats would go out the door to go get printed at the Goleta Sun at about 2 o'clock in the morning every day. And so we were running from 7:30 a.m. till about 2:30 a.m. And that really was my education. So when I get asked about my GPA, which fortunately is not that frequent, I really speak to the more well-rounded education that I got here, the life experience I had rather than the classroom experience. And I would have had to have sacrificed all that in my spin to have gotten a better GPA. So not the ideal answer, but the short answer is your GPA matters depending on what you want to go do. And there's a narrow range of functions, including going on to grad school, where it actually has pretty much a great deal of significance. For most career paths, including nearly everything entrepreneurial, your grades just aren't going to be as big a factor in finding what you want and getting the role with the right exciting company.
I wish I had known your GPA. I would not have invested.
Sorry, I got a good story for it. So
okay, we have one last question in the back.
Yeah.
Hey, Jason, thanks for the words. My question is, so you majored in political science for undergrad, and you mentioned how an engineer is really high in demand, majors like that. What would be your advice to somebody who's in an undergraduate major that is not necessarily training for a career after college, like accounting or engineering or something like that, and then being able to apply that degree into a career path similar to yours?
So my junior year, I declared my major to be communications because it looked easy. I switched from that, and I had to choose between philosophy and political science because those are the two things I had the most units in. I mean, who in the hell has a bunch of units in philosophy, right? I did by my senior year. So I picked poli-sci, not a useful degree at all. You can go to law school without being a poli-sci major, certainly. My suggestion there, with hindsight, this is not something I understood at the time, is the degree doesn't matter a whole lot. If you're getting a technical degree, right? The only friend I knew that had a job coming out of school when we graduated was an accounting major, and he had a job lined up with an accounting firm. So my suggestion would be spend some time thinking about what it is you actually enjoy from an industry perspective, from a role type of perspective. If you're really into sports, there are so many exciting opportunities to go build businesses and join exciting businesses that are in the sporting world. If you're in entertainment, there's so many different things you can go do. Fashion, travel, you name it. I mean, I would say, again, with your risk profile being about as low as it's ever going to be in your life, this is that time to try, if you can, to get a sense of what you actually care about, what you're passionate about, and go look at different ways that people are making money within that industry and go find an opportunity that way with zero regard for what your degree is in. Because if you're able to sit down and tell a story about your passion to these folks who are building a business in an area that you're excited about, they're going to bet so much more on that than they would on your GPA or on your major. So I would, again, focus on looking for those opportunities, look to create relationships using tools like LinkedIn and others to build those bonds, create relationships, because that, I think, more so than the nature of your degree or your GPA or whether you took too many years to get out of school, that is going to be the most important factor in helping you find what you want to do. And as trite as it sounds, because you guys have probably heard it a dozen times by now, if you find something that you enjoy doing, you will not have trouble making money at it. The passion for what you do will help you make enough money to support whatever lifestyle you want to have. And the people that I know that have pursued careers mainly around money, mostly the lawyers and the bankers, they work their tails off. They make a fair amount of money. But those are the folks that tell you that they would do it differently if they had another chance. And in fact, there was a study I read recently that said 90% of attorneys say that if they could do it over again, they'd pick a different career path. And 90% of college professors say that they would do it all over again. So some food for thought there. I would encourage you guys to spend more time thinking about what you actually love and what you want to do and make a difference in, rather than my grades, my major, how am I going to make the most money right out of the gate. I think you will have a lot more happiness. Nothing's going to rival your 4-plus years here, by the way, so good luck with that. So anyway, I thank you all for the time today, and my contact information is here. If you're interested at all in following up, whether it's jobs or if you're over 21 swinging by the Ring Revenue Pub for a beer, please get in touch with me. I would love to help you guys out any way I can.
Thank you, Jason. That was great.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.